Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Was I hearing things, or is that another new intro?
Could be another new one.
They don't give our name. I think we're being replaced.
Could be.
Hello, everybody. This is Michael Norris and Bobby Simmons, and we may or may not be joined by our third free bird, Jerry Hodes. He had another town council meeting tonight, and he was hoping to it wouldn't go long. He'll be able to join us later on. But he may not be able to join us at all. You know, it is election year, so I think he's laying the groundwork. He's going to run for something down there. Not run from something, run for it.
That's better. If I had that job he had, I wouldn't want to be going nowhere.
I think maybe he got called in front of the council because maybe he was measuring those bikinis.
Yeah.
Got a complaint on he'd kill us if he knew we were talking about him. Well, we are we're going to be a little slow getting started, but we're going to continue our conversation that we started last week about wrestling relations and families, both work and real. And we're going to be joined at some point by our good friend Scott Teal. Scott called me a little bit ago. He's feeling a little under the weather, so he was going to go by and try and get some medication to help him out a little bit. And, of course, he's on the road driving tonight. So hopefully he'll be joining us here very shortly, and we'll be good to go. So, but anyway, and something I failed to mention that I should have, with Bobby and I both being such Andy Griffith fans, that neither one of us talked about last week, that our hero, Andy Griffith, passed away. And just not only us, but a lot of people fall into that category.
Yeah, grew up with that show. I can remember as a kid, you know, part of my bedtime routine was I had to get on the couch at 9 o'clock, and I had to lay on the couch because Mom knew I'd go to sleep. But I had to lay on the couch, but she would let me stay up till like 9:30 to watch Andy Griffith. It came, if I ain't mistaken, it was on Monday night. And even now, I mean, I own the whole series on DVD, and anytime it's on TV, I watch it and just... you know the dialogue before they say it. You've seen them so many times, but they're just that comedy never ends, and it just it amazes me. You know, no vulgar language, no nudity, and they're as funny today as they were back in the '60s.
Oh, absolutely, and it kind of does tie into the wrestling business because if you think Channel 17, when I first discovered Channel 17 in the late '70s, the only thing he's had was the Braves games, wrestling, and the Andy Griffith Show. That's what I remember from it.
You know, people that don't remember back in those days, we were, you're absolutely right. You know, 17 started out as, I mean, there wasn't any original program when Turner started this station. I mean, it was he started in an old, it was originally the building that he went into was originally Channel 5. And, of course, Channel 5 moved out to this big, huge facility on the other side of Atlanta. And Turner moved into this. The studio with the ring in there was would seat maybe 100 people, maybe not that many. And, I mean, it was a very small studio. And he built everything from there. He owned this station, and he had one in Charlotte. Both... UHF stations, and that was very new to Atlanta. I mean, they're just we had the network stations 2, 5, and 11, and Channel 8 was a educational
Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Yeah.
And
there
and was. That was it's yeah, that was it. And then 17 came along, and it was interesting back in the day. I know I've told you this, but the first time I ever went to Turner Station, I went to put the ring up the very first day we were there, and I could not get in the back door. I couldn't get anybody to come to the door. So I took my pocket knife and I jimmied the door and opened it, not knowing if I'd set an alarm off or not. I opened it and got inside, and I weaved my way through, and I came to the control room, and there was a guy back there, and he was barefooted, playing a guitar and smoking a joint. And it was 7:30 in the morning, and when he seen me, I said, "I'm here to put the ring up." And he just threw his hand up and kept on playing his guitar. And every once in a while, he'd reach up and hit a button or something on the control board there. But he was the only one there. He was running the whole station by himself that morning. So it was.
Now, where was that station back in those days? That's the one they used to call White Columns, right?
No. White Columns was WSB. That was out at this one. This station was. It was on West Peachtree Street, just north of 10th Street. If you go up West Peach Street and you cross 10th Street, Michael, there's a building on the first building you come to on your left. It was originally back in that in the day, it was the headquarters for Blue Cross Blue Shield in Atlanta on one side, and the TV station was on the other side.
Okay.
The big tall tower is still there. It's still behind the building.
I'm exactly
not mistaken now, one of the cable networks or cable stations or cable companies here in Atlanta actually owns that building now and uses it.
I know that spot very well because I used, when I worked for Macy's, that's where we would, during the Eggleston Christmas Parade, we would close off West Peachtree Street up to where it intersected with Peachtree. And we would actually, that was the end of the parade route.
Yeah,
and we would land the helium balloons right there in front of that spot you're talking about. Now, when did they move over there on Techwood?
I want to say, now I'm guessing because time just all those years run together with me, Michael. I want to say it was somewhere around 78, 79, could have been 80 even.
Okay, but it was after the war.
Oh, yeah. Oh, a long time after the war.
Because I know that's where we take TV when I was going over there to do jobs on TV was at Techwood.
Yeah, when I first went to work and started putting the TV ring up, we were still at Channel 11. But we were only there I was only there maybe 3 weeks. And then that's when Gunkel signed the contract with Turner. We moved that ring. We were like the Baltimore Colts. Me and Larry Nichols went and loaded that ring up and moved it in the middle of the night. And we moved it down to 17, and we put it down there. And then that first Saturday, I went in and set it up. And that would have been 1970, about 70, 71 maybe, somewhere in there, I'm guessing. I'm pretty sure it was 70. But that's when he first went down there. And he went down there because Channel 11 kept jacking him around on his time. 1 week would be... No, but you couldn't find it. 1 week he was on at 10:30. 1 week you were on at midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning. Anything they had, they would bump wrestling. And when we went down to Turner, the whole start of this conversation was to tell you this. Back in the day you're talking, when it was Andy Griffith and the Braves, we were the number one rated show that Turner had. I mean, outdrawing the Braves. Our numbers were better than the Braves. They were better than anything else he ran on the station. And when the Superstation thing came about, it really popped. Barnett was real big on the numbers, but that's how he kind of kept up with where the show was being watched and things were going on. It was phenomenal, the following we had.
And then at somewhere, they started their own original programming besides the game, the Braves, and the wrestling.
They did some of that while we were still in the little studio there. They came up, and I can't remember what it was called, but they came up with some show where they actually had tables set up like you were in a small cabaret or club atmosphere, and they would have live entertainment come in. They used to do that like a Wednesday night during the week, and they would film this 30, 45-hour show, whatever it was. And we used to go up there, and we'd sit in the back and watch them film it. It was very interesting. But, yeah, Bill Tush, who became sort of a star there in the Atlanta area, he used to do some stuff there too.
Yeah, that's what I said. He started having his own Sunday morning show.
Yeah.
It was like an hour, 2 hour show, and it was a combination of stuff. He would do like weird things in the news, and then he'd do some sort of little skit, and it was more or less a comedy show. And it went through a lot of different variations before it settled on a format. But it's funny because I used to, 9 times out of 10, when I would work the matches there at TBS studio, I wound up using his cubicle as my dressing
area. Yeah.
And there was a girl, what was her name, Bonnie something or other. She got real popular later on as a Bonnie Turner. She was a writer. She was involved with that, as was Rhett Butler, the comedian Rhett Butler. She was on that show as well. And the two of them went on to bigger and better things. I think Bonnie Turner ended up writing Designing Women or was one of the producers of that show, which was set in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Rhett Butler, of course, had her own show there for a while. But I don't know whatever became of Bill Tush. You never hear about him anymore.
I don't know.
But he was a big thing. He was right along with Louis Brizard and what was the other?
Rod Hudspeth,
yeah.
Yeah. Atlanta was kind of a, it was a different mix. There was all kind of folks here that were very popular, not only here, but to kind of, you know, Grizzard and Hudspeth, you know, they syndicated, and of course, 17, like I say, when the Superstation thing hit, these local stars all of a sudden became national stars, and there was some good times back there, but there were some strange times. I remember one morning I was putting the TV ring up, and I thought I was in the building. I thought the only other person in the building was a guy in the back running the board. And it's like 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and I didn't have any other lights on in the studio, so it was kind of dark. But I kept hearing this racket. I mean, it was this noise, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And it was bothering me because I didn't know if somebody was in the building or, you know. So I went investigating, and I went upstairs, and I found Ted Turner under his desk. He had this was in his Playboy days, and he had been out Friday night and had a little too much. And he was under his desk, and he was trying to get out from under it, and he couldn't quite figure it out. And he didn't see me, so I just eased the door to and went on back downstairs. But it was some fun days back then.
Is he still in Atlanta at all? I mean, I know he has that huge ranch in Wyoming.
You know, I don't think so, Mike. I don't see anything about him. If he is, he's very, very on the QT because you just don't see much about him here anymore. I think he's staying out in Montana.
Now, I know Atlanta, TBS is no longer the TBS that everybody knows. It's become something else. It's the Time Warner and all that merger and buyout and all this stuff.
Right.
But is it Peachtree TV or whatever
Peachtree
it is?
Peachtree TV is what they call it now.
The TBS, what is the TBS, mix there?
TBS still has a station.
Right.
It's I've got DirecTV. TBS is something like 247 or something on DirecTV.
Right.
You've got TNT, the Turner Network Television, which they do a lot of their own. They've actually got some very good shows on that. They do their own, you know, production stuff there. The Turner Classic Movies. You've got the Cartoon Network is a Turner thing.
Right.
CNN, of course, and of course, he don't own any of that anymore. But it still carries his name, and it's the original studio on Techwood when we moved over there. Remember, it was a red brick, looked like a mansion.
Yeah.
That was originally what that was. It was called the Progressive Club, and it was a very exclusive club for men, sort of like you see on TV where the folks go smoke the cigars and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what that was, and when he bought that. Now, if you go up through the, if you go up I-75 now and you look over toward that, that original building is still there. But they have built 15 to 20-story buildings all the way around it. It sort of sits in the middle. It's sort of the centerpiece of that complex. But all the buildings around it are like I say, are 20, 25 stories. And there's probably five or six of those on that property now.
Well, is that still used as a studio of any kind?
You know, I don't know. I hadn't been in there in years. I would assume so. I would think so because it was such a massive studio, you know, where they knocked walls out and created that. But I would think so. You know, they still do, you know, the NBA, they do their halftime and their pregame shows from Atlanta, and I would think probably that they've got a lot of that set up in there. I would think, you know, I don't know, but I would think they probably still do.
Now, back when I saw my Peachtree TV, what is, I know they show Braves games. What else is their program?
They're doing syndication shows. They do,
okay.
And I don't watch it that much, but, you know, like King of Queens and some of the CBS shows and different shows that were, I think they show Seinfeld and just anything that's in syndication. They don't do back to its roots.
It's like,
yeah, they don't do any original programming there that I know of other than Braves games.
That's something I can't. Well, I take that back. I was somewhere. I was either with Ron West or with the clown eating dinner the other night, and the Braves were playing. But it's only because they were playing the New York Mets that I happened to get to see.
Yeah,
I didn't recognize one player outside of Chipper Jones.
Chipper's the only old timer left, and this is his last year.
Yeah,
he's retiring. So it's a. Yeah, it's different. It's a different world now, my boy. It's a, I don't know. Sometimes I wish you could go back to like it was, but then again, they say you can't go home again, so I guess that's true.
Well, our special guest is calling in, so let me get Scott on the line with us. Good evening, Mr. Teal. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm struggling with this throat thing. It wasn't anything serious. It just drainage, I guess, caused my throat to have problems. But I'll see if I can muddle through this. How y'all doing?
Doing great.
I'm doing outstanding.
Good deal. Outstanding.
Yeah, you know, Michael, I can't believe last week after we were talking about all these brother teams, the one, you know. And Scott emailed us a whole list of people that we missed, and some of them were so obvious it was embarrassing. But one that I thought about this week that we didn't talk about was the Burrhead brothers. Burrhead Bennett, Burrhead Jones, and Burrhead Teal was their manager. I can't believe I forgot that one.
The Flying Burrhead brothers.
And they may be brothers. I'm not sure.
I don't go out in the sun as much as I used to, so we don't look as much alike anymore. Is Jerry there? Is Jerry there tonight?
No, he's hoping to join us later on, but he had a town council meeting there, and he's I don't know if he's testifying or what he's
doing. Yeah.
You know, when you're a big high city official like he is.
I know. You'll have to pay him to be on the show for too long.
Yeah. Don't give him any ideas.
Speaking of things you learned last week from all those family names, I have pretty good records. You know, I have a lot of files, a lot of information. And one y'all mentioned last week, I learned something. I really had never thought about it, but after you talk, I mean, I knew about it, this father-son team, but afterwards I got thinking, and it just really struck me funny. It really makes me wonder, Bobby, you'll probably have to answer this, but with the father-son team of Charlie Smith and Bobby Simmons, why do y'all have different last names?
Well,
It's just so people to, you know, I mean, it's to keep the fans away. Charlie had so many women chasing him. I didn't, you know, I was trying to keep my, you know, my wife happy, so I didn't want all them women chasing me. Absolute true story. When Charlie's middle son passed away a few years ago, he asked me to do the service. I go to the funeral home, and they come in and they hand me the little minister's card, and it had all, you know, they give you a card and it's got all the survivors and the date of death, you know, just the vital information. But down at the bottom it said service conducted by Reverend Bobby Smith.
Oh, no, I love
it. It did, and I've still got it here somewhere. And I went back in there, and I told that funeral director, I said, was this a joke? And the guy goes, what? And I said, this Bobby Smith. I said, or is there somebody here besides me? He goes, oh, he said, Reverend Simmons, I'm so sorry. I said, no, don't change it. I said, this, you couldn't have done nothing no better. I said, this is I'll get a lot of mileage out of this. But I've still got it here somewhere, but, yeah. It's.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Well, speaking of learning something, Scott threw out a trivia challenge here, and this is one I don't even know the answer of. And I'm gonna ask the question, and if anybody that's listening to us tonight knows the answer, feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 347-324-5735. And the question is, we all know who Toru Kamada is. Very well-known Japanese wrestler, also worked as Dr. Moto in the AWA in the 60s. He had a true-life brother who was also in the wrestling business. It was something I didn't know. And Scott has the answer, but I'm going to wait a while before he gives it to us, if anybody happens to know it and can call in. And I guess what you'll win is a day on the beach with Jerry Oates. Right on his scooter.
Me too. That makes me easy to catch.
That's funny.
But I went back, and something we really didn't touch much on last week were married couples. And I took a little time this afternoon, just ones that I know in my head without doing any kind of research. I came up with 28 different couples, and I'm sure
wow.
I missed some. But I had no clue that there was that many. And I'm going to read off some of the ones that I found. Now, some of them may not be familiar to a lot of people because they go back quite a ways. And the first one would be the first couple I named or thought of and wrote down was Al, and I hope I pronounced his last name right, Zatz and Ada Ash. Ada Ash was an early ladies' woman champion before Mildred Burke. And they did a. He was a wrestler. What's that?
She wrestled a lot up in the Boston area, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. I think they were both from up that way. And I think they kind of had their own troupe that toured around, but they did things like they owned Wrestling Bears and did all kind of other different stuff, too. I think he wrestled professionally, but I think he was also involved in at shows as well. And there was another couple, and I'm not sure if the husband wrestled or not. I couldn't remember his name. We've talked about him on here all the time. It was one of those promoters that just went all over the place. And, Scott, you'll know, as soon as I mention the woman's name, you'll probably come up with the husband's name. Violet Ray was her name.
Yeah, Donald Van Fleet. That's the one y'all talked about.
Yeah, now, did he wrestle as well? I know he promoted a lot, but did he wrestle as well?
I don't believe so. I think he just promoted. I don't remember ever reading anything about him wrestling. I could be wrong, but I don't believe so.
And then, of course, it was Billy Wolf and Mildred Burke. Sam Menneker and June Byers. June Byers was also married to Billy Wolf's son at one point. I don't know if that was before or after Sam Menneker. Carl Kowalski and Carol Corrado.
Was that June Byers was with Mildred Burke was married to her son. I get them confused. Must have been June Byers.
No, June Byers was married to Sam Menneker. I know.
Okay, that's right. Okay, but you're saying Mildred Burke was married to Billy Wolf and his son.
No, Mildred Burke was married to Billy Wolf. June Byers was married to Billy Wolf's son.
Okay.
I don't know if that was before or after Sam Menneker.
Yeah.
She was married to Billy G. Wolf.
Yeah.
And then another couple I just named, Carl Kowalski and Carol Corrada. And there was Pancho Villa, otherwise known as Roberto Pico Bobby Lane, who was married to Ann Laverne. And they had two children who got in the wrestling business, Bobby Pico Jr., or Bobby Lane, as he was known, and Marie Laverne. And Marie Laverne was married to Gordon Nelson. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see, Ripper Collins and Barbara Baker. Boy McClarty and Shirley Strumpel. Helen Hill, who most people know as Ted DiBiase's mother, was actually married to two different wrestlers. She was first married to Spider Galento, and then she was married to a band leader or something. And I don't know. I don't have his name written down anywhere. Then she, who was Ted's biological father, and then she married Mike DiBiase, who adopted Ted. And of course, Ted now has. Two or three sons involved in the wrestling business now.
Hmm. Yep.
So that carries on that tradition. And then Moolah was married to two different wrestlers. She was married to Johnny Long, which is not the Johnny Long that most people think of in Tennessee, whose real name was Bill Strozier, who worked as Billy Strong and Bob Dalton. This was a Johnny Long that worked in the 30s and 40s. And then I'm assuming she was married to Buddy Lee. I don't know if they were actually ever married or not. She, in her book, she writes it, calls him her husband. And, of course, then Buddy Lee went on and later married Rita Cortez.
Yep.
In the Gulf Coast area, we had Chief Little Eagle, who was married to... Vinny Venus LaRue, and we also had Greg and Bobby Peterson.
Yep.
Then, let's see, Danny Jack Donovan and Vern Bottoms, Ruth Bernard and Betty Hawkins, and that's one I get to. She was such a nice-looking lady, and Ruth Bernard was Ruth Bernard. She must have thought he had money hidden away or something. I don't know. let's see. George Becker and the original Joyce Grable, Joyce Fowler. Buddy Wolf and Vivian Vachon. Donnie Weaver and Penny Banner. Mark Tenler and Kitty Adams. Billy Blue River and Beverly Shade. Akio Saito and Betty Nikolai. Ron Schroeder and Leilani Kai, Juan Sebastian and Belle Starr, Bill Dromo and Karen Wolf, Tom Ernesto and Kathy Branch, who had two kids who became wrestlers, Jim Tall Tree, and Tom Branch, Tom Ernesto Jr., who now works for Old Brother Circus, and of course, Cadill and Sarah Lee. Those are all the ones I came up with. Can you guys think of anybody else?
Yeah, Benny McGuire was married. He actually trained this girl. Her name was Tammy Love. She lives in the Carolinas now. She's remarried, and her last name is Cain, C-A-I-N. And,
I've heard of Tammy Love, but I have no clue that she was married to him.
Were you at Mobile the year he came?
No, he came the year before I started with Bobby.
Yeah, she was with him then, and she just emailed me here just recently. She's apparently in bad health, but she's doing okay, and like I said, she's gotten remarried. She wrestled quite a while. Another one is Roger Kirby, and I'm not real sure they're ever really married. I believe they were, but Early Dawn she wrestled as in Indianapolis area a lot.
Okay. Yeah, she worked down in Florida, typically Dawn did.
Yes, uh-huh. And then, yes, Stu Schwartz. I don't know if you mentioned Stu or not, and Bonnie Watson.
No, I did not mention Stu and Bonnie. I didn't even think about them.
Yeah.
And while you were just talking, I just thought of somebody else. Let me make sure I get which Tyler it is. I think it's Randy Tyler, the original Randy Tyler, not Monroe Rice, but Randy...
Marvin Hickman.
Marvin Hickman, yeah. No, Marvin Hickman was Tim Tyler. Randy Tyler was, what was his name?
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. I
can't think of it, but he was married to a girl who used, I don't know what her real name was, but she wrestled under the name of Patsy Cline. She spelled her name K-L-Y-N-N instead of Patsy Cline.
Was it Carl Reed?
Carl Reed, yeah, that's it, Carl Reed. But yeah, they were a couple too. I forgot about them.
No, I didn't even know that. Never heard that one.
Yep.
Wow.
See, I don't know where all she worked. I know she worked in Mobile a couple times back in the late 60s, early 70s. But and the reason I had heard of her, but how I found out they were married, Gary Lathan and I were talking, and he mentioned that Carl tried to open up and run in West Virginia sometime in the mid 70s and wanted Terry to go work there with him, and but it all fell through, and he just happened to mention that he was married to Patsy Cline.
Huh. Yeah, there's Eddie Gilbert and Missy Hyatt.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, and then, well, he was married to Medusa Michelli, right? As well, Deborah Michelli?
Yeah.
She wasn't she was. At some point married to Greg Valentine? She was married to several guys, I think, or at least lived with several guys. Hard to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't even get into the ones that are, you know, current, you know, like Kimberly and Dallas Page and people like that. I didn't even get into anything beyond the.
I give you one back from 73, 74. Roger
that?
Smith, who wrestled as Bull Zomar,
right.
And he was an assassin,
really?
In all different places. He married Valerie Griffith, who was from Columbus, who worked.
Who broke in with Joyce Grable, right? They broke in together. The
broke in
one.
Together, yeah, yeah. Actually, I was at their wedding. Wayne Cowan was Roger's best man at that wedding. That's probably 73, maybe, early 74.
Huh. I didn't know that. You say he wrestled as Bull Zomar?
Bull Zomar.
Where
yeah,
was
he
that?
Worked
Z-O-M-A-R.
With the IWA, with Iron Horns Group.
Oh, okay. Cool. I'll have to look that one up. I just
and he
that.
Worked for Ann Gunkel, too. That's where I met him.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's probably worked his own more, Bill Zomar with her.
Huh.
And then he started his many, many mask gimmicks and all the others. And Scott,
yeah.
I printed off Scott's list that Bobby mentioned, and he mentioned, which you sent a list of father and son, of course, which were, you know, Bob Orton Sr., Bob Orton Jr., now Randy
uh-huh.
Orton. You know, Leo Garibaldi, Tony and Matt Bourne, Nick and Griff Beyer, Angelo Lanny and Randy Poffo.
Let me ask before you go on to talk about some of these. What do you remember, Bobby, about Angelo Lanny and Randy when they first came in to work for Ant Gaunt? Was that the first time you met them? Was when they
first time I met them. The first one I met was Lanny. Angelo brought him down and left him here. And I remember he bought him he had a brand new Volkswagen Beetle, no air conditioning. And Renesto called me in the office, and he introduced me to Lanny, and he said, "This is your wife for the next 2 weeks." He said, "You go to every town with him, make sure he knows how to get to the towns, and, you know, just ride with him. You know, I don't care if you drive, he drives, whatever." But I mean, Lanny's a smart fella, but back then he wasn't the brightest crayon in the box.
Yeah.
I mean, he was very flaky. He would, he did some strange things, something that I can't talk about. But he very, very off the wall. And then Angelo came into work. And Angelo was, you know, fairly easy to get along with. Didn't have any problems with Angelo. I found out how tight he was. Those stories that you hear about him pinching pennies is true.
Absolutely.
And then Randy was the last one to make an appearance here. And Randy had just been released by whatever minor league ball system he was in. And Randy was ambidextrous. He was his, you know, I like that word. I can use that word every once in a while.
I always said I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous.
Yeah, you got that right. Whatever minor league system he was in, they had monkeyed with his head, and they had done experiments with him. They were trying to make him a pitcher. He was actually a catcher, but they were trying to make him a pitcher that could throw either-handed. In other words, if a right-handed guy come in the box, he could throw right-handed, and if a left-handed guy come in, he'd throw left. Well, anyway, it messed him up, and that was the start of it. And then, of course, he discovered different kinds of ways to mess himself up further. But first time I ever seen him, he weighed 190 pounds soaking wet. He was the size of a pencil, and he wrestled under a mask as the Spider.
And he looked like it.
He did. And you know, even then, even before he got, I mean, he would herbally medicate himself, among other things, and we know that. It's no secret. Even before that, he was bouncing off the walls. I mean, he was like bing, 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 you know, and he was all over the place. But that was, you know, that was kind of my first impressions of these guys. And of course, I want to say me and Lanny became somewhat friends. He mellowed out a little bit there. Just to go back to clarify what I said about he went to Savannah. After I quit riding with him, he drove to Savannah on his own. And he got down there, and he didn't have any gas, and he didn't have any money. And, of course, they wouldn't take a check, you know, because they didn't know who he was. And I don't remember what kind of watch he had, but it was worth $400 or $500. He got a tank of gas and left that watch with the guy at the gas station to pay for the gas and told him he'd be back next week to pick it up and pay him for the gas.
Oh, my goodness.
And just very fortunate, the guy was honest, and when he went back the next week, he took the money, and the guy gave him his watch back.
Wow.
You know, but
I was struck by the total difference in the way Lanny and Randy carried themselves. I mean, they were just so opposite in character.
Oh, yeah. It was just, that was, Debbie, my wife, got to, when she was in Nashville with Vicky, when Vicky was in school up there, and they were up there, Debbie got kind of close to Judy, Angelo's wife. And Debbie's told me stories that Judy would just sit and cry. I mean, she says, I can't believe I raised these two. I mean, it was just, they said they would go to a Shoney's to eat, and Angelo would make Judy order off the kids' menu.
Yeah,
he'd tell her. He said, "You're not going to eat that much anyway, so you know we'll just." Oh, it was. I never met this, but Angelo's daddy, you know, he was like 90 something, and he had dementia of some sort. But anyway, he always thought the Italian mafia was after him.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, can you imagine living in that zoo? Oh, jeez.
Oh no. So that was a good example, that family, of how wrestling used to base their ring personas not on just something the promoter decided they wanted to make them a character, but it was based on their real-life attitude. Like, Angelo wrestled under the hood as the Miser.
Yeah.
You know, and the carpenter, and it all had to do with money, you know, and it just fit him so perfectly. And, of course, Randy's character, you know, the sort of the wild, wide-eyed, you know, sort of crazy guy. That was Randy.
That was
him.
Just,
absolutely. And I can see Lanny, you know, as the genius, and you know, as the poet. You know, I don't know if you remember a little book he gave out. He gave me a copy of it way back in the 70s. It's called, what was it called? I've got it here somewhere. Something about the yellow streak down somebody's back or something. I'll have to look that thing up. It's a funny book. I'll have to copy and send it to
you. Well, you know, I've always heard that there's a very thin line between insanity and genius.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and Lanny is a great example of that. And, you know, I'm not saying bad things about the guy. I'm just saying he could talk very intelligently to you, and then all of a sudden he'd go off the deep end about something.
Yeah.
It would make no sense. And, you know, I mean, that's just, and like you say, that's the way he was.
Yes. So,
but I can honestly, I never had a problem with any of those guys, you know, either in the ring, out of the ring. And, you know, I never traveled with Angelo or Randy, and that was by choice. But
yeah.
made a lot of trips with Lanny, and I contacted Lanny by email when Angelo passed away and when Randy passed away, just to pass on my condolences. So,
yeah.
One of the things I used to drive him crazy with, he would ask me, he'd say, "What are you doing today?" I said, "Nothing, just killing time." And that genius part in him would start trying to dissect that sentence. How can you kill time? So I remembered that after all those years, and when I wrote him, I said, "Well, still killing time in Georgia."
Signed it. I love it. Yeah, I got along with them both when they were here, and Angelo. I only had one incident with Randy, and it was exactly like you said. He became a madman, but Tom Renesto came up to me one time, and he told me to. They were trying to get, people were calling, you know, that they would be in the ring wrestling each other, you know, because it was Lanny Poffo and Randy Savage.
Yeah.
And people would yell at the ring, "Your brothers," and all this stuff. So Tom Renesto came to him and he says, "I want you to write a story next week for the front of the program and talk about how we've uncovered some evidence that these two might be related. And just leave it at that." So that's what I did, and he told me, he says, "What we're going to do the next week, I want you to come back with an article about we've uncovered some documents in county courthouses or wherever, and we come to realize these two guys are cousins." And he says, "That way we can probably maybe get away from the brother thing. It's no big deal for cousins to wrestle each other." Because back then, really, brothers wrestling each other wasn't really accepted.
Right.
You know, they just didn't do that. And so I printed the first story about, you know, we've uncovered something, and we sort of, finding out these two guys might be related. Well, Randy went ballistic. 2 o'clock in the morning one morning, my phone rings, and it was him. He cussed me 10 minutes about this, about how I was trying to expose them as brothers and ruin his career. And I said, "Randy," I said, "Tom told me print that. We're going to come back the next week with a deal about you being cousins so we can get away from the brother." He would not hear it. I mean, he just went nuts. And I said, "Okay, that's fine." So, next week, Tom says, "I need you to do that story." And I said, "Nope." I said, "I will never put Randy in this program again until he talks to me in a decent way." And so I didn't even print the retraction. So from then on, everybody knew they were brothers. But and I didn't. And Randy went out, left the territory not long after that. And we really didn't say much to each other that whole time. He came back, and he came up to me when he came back several months later, and sort of halfway apologized and says, "I'm, you know, it's just one of those things." He says, "I understand." He says, "I apologize for..." Well, then we got along fine. I put him back in the program, you know. And so, but that was the only problem I ever had with Randy. He was a good guy, but he just went off the deep end there. You just always had to be watching, I guess.
Well, like I say, that was his personality. And then when he discovered chemical ways to enhance his personality, trying to be nice here, you never knew what you were going to get.
Right.
We were talking a little bit about this last week with Jerry. You know, I mean, guys come in the dressing room, man, and you can look at their eyes and tell that they ain't nobody home. I mean, it was scary.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, they, and before, I want to mention their time in Mobile, but I just thought of another married couple, Doug Gilbert and Kane Opal. How in the world I forgot about those two.
Who is that?
Doug Gilbert and Kane Opal.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
But, and I know Scott knows this story because he interviewed Rip Tyler before he passed away for whatever happened to. And Rip was the booker in Mobile when the Poffos came to work there in early 1976. And I think they were there maybe 2 months. And they were working a program over the Gulf Coast Tag Team title with the original British Bulldogs, who were John Boley, and another family member, his son-in-law, Ted Heath.
Oh, yeah, right. I forgot
and,
that.
Somewhere along the line, the Poffos, Angelo was working as their manager, and it was Lanny and Randy that were doing the actual wrestling. They did work some six-mans against the Bulldogs and Duke Miller, who was kind of taken over as the Bulldogs manager at that point. But somewhere along the line, and it may be because of the medication kicking in, that the Poffos decided they were going to try and shoot on Foley and Ted Heath, which
is
not a smart thing to do to begin with. But they had snuck blackjacks into the ring. And I don't know who was refereeing the match, but anyway, they changed the finish and ended the match real quick. And
I'm going to interrupt you there. If I'm not mistaken, it was Reuben Gibson. I think he told me that last get-together we had here. He had just started refereeing, and he was the referee of that match.
Yeah, because Reuben was refereeing back in those days. And but anyway, when they got back to the dressing room, Rip Tyler confronted them. And Angelo went to get a pistol out of his bag, and but before he could get there, Eddie Sullivan had gone into his bag and pulled out his pistol. And this, Lanny still disputes this next part, and I guess he will from now on. But according to what Rip Tyler said, Randy smarted off to Rip, and Rip basically cleaned his clock for him.
Just slapped him.
Slapped him several times. But they were fired that night and ran out of the territory. So they didn't last very long in Mobile. But I remember the first time. I had known who they were because Angelo Poffo was a well-known name. But Lanny and Randy were both, I think they had come to Mobile from Detroit, which is probably where they went from Georgia. But they were working up there for the Sheik. And so, you know, they were in magazine and stuff, so I knew who they were. But Lanny was doing the Ricky Starr type thing. He was doing the ballet and the gymnastics and the tumbling and all that stuff. And instead of being interviewed, Angelo and Randy would talk on the interviews, but Lanny would just stand behind him and do somersaults and cartwheels, stuff like that. And I thought, this was strange. But they got over pretty well. They put the belts on them the first week they were there, but then, you know, that incident happened, and they were gone.
What would give them to? I mean, what thought process would go through either one of those guys' minds, including Angelo, that they could shoot on Ted Heath or John Foley?
Well, they weren't really shooting. What it was?
They were going to try.
Randy accused Heath and Foley of taking liberties in the ring, you know, in previous matches and sort of stretching them a little bit, and. So what they did that night that this incident happened, they actually took blackjacks into the ring in their tights.
And when
they got there and started beating the two of them, they figured if they had blackjacks, they could probably catch them off guard, you know, and pull them out of their tights and hit them and take care of them before they could, you know, because Ted Heath, I mean, he's no slouch. Foley will kill you. I mean, Foley just look at you and kill you. You know, that guy was tough.
Foley taught Gotch.
That's right.
And looked me in my eye one night in Atlanta. We were talking about it. He looked at me and he said, "A teacher never teaches his pupil everything."
That's right.
He was telling me in a polite way that he thought he could still beat Gotch. And I had no reason to doubt him.
Wow.
I'd have been scared of John Foley if I'd had a loaded pistol in my hand.
Let me tell you something. This chunky referee was in Carrollton one night, and somebody didn't show up, and there happened to be two referees there that night, and they told me, they said, "Put your tights on, you're going to work tonight." And me and a guy from North Georgia named Buddy Atlas went into a tag match against Norman Frederick Charles and John Foley. Now, I'm going to tell you something. If he had told me to crap, I'd have squatted right there in the ring. I was as afraid of him as I was. Now, he was as gentle and nice to me as anybody has ever been. But, son, you talk about scared.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I knew what he could do.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's a shame he ended up, too. He became an alcoholic, and he worked for Stu Hart for a long time, and his career sort of went, you know, downhill. And Stu was nice enough to, you know, use him and, you know, continue to, you know, give him a good place he could make a little bit of a living. But it was a shame that he wound up like he did.
Yeah.
Well, let me go back to another. I mentioned father and son, Gino and Leo Garibaldi. Of course, Gino was one of. There were four brothers, but I can only remember the three: Gino, Chick, and Ralph. But there were four brothers, but I can't remember his name.
I can't. I don't know if I ever knew it.
Let's see.
I know there was another Garibaldi, but I don't know if the other Garibaldi was really a Garibaldi. There was a, let's see. I was just looking that up real quick. There was a John Garibaldi, but that wasn't a real Garibaldi.
No, no. There were, because Leo, I don't know if Leo has a site anymore for it since he's passed away, if it's gone down, but at one time he had a site that had photos and stuff, and he mentioned all four of his dad and his three uncles.
Chick Tony, Joe. There's four
Tony.
Uncles.
Tony was the other one. That's it. Tony Garibaldi, Ralph Garibaldi.
And there's one named Joe who had a real short career.
Okay. I was thinking Joe, but then I was thinking I was confusing with the Deucers.
Yeah, that's true. But no,
there was Ernie, Emil, Joe, Rudy, and there was actually a Wally Deucek prior to the Wally Deucek. There was the fake cousin. There was actually, they did have a younger brother named Walter or Wally Deucek, but he only wrestled for like a year or two. And then, of course, they came up with Wally that was a work cousin, and Danny Deucek, another work cousin, but they worked together as the Deucek brothers, Wally and Danny did. I'm not clear where Frank comes in, if he's the son of the fake Wally or if he's the son of the real Wally.
Oh, yeah. I always understood it was Wally wasn't, like I said, wasn't really a Deucek, and he was
right.
The father of Frank, but I don't know
right.
Which one that
was. But there really was a Wally Happy, because their real last name was Hasten, and there really was a Walter or Wally Hasten that worked as Wally Deucek, but like I said, he had a short career. And then along came the one that ended up working for Crockett in the office. It was a wrestler for many years. And, of course, he had a work brother, Danny, who you were very familiar with being in Tennessee, Sid Neighbors.
Yes, I know. Yes.
Was Frank the guy that had – was he the one that had the crippled hand?
Frank was the guy that was on the World Class Championship Wrestling as a commentator.
Okay.
And he wrestled some too.
There was a Deucek that when we were working for Ann, there was a Deucek that refereed some, and he had a slight deformity in one of his hands. And I can't remember. I wanted to say it was Frank, but that may not be right.
But yeah, I don't know that.
He was.
I don't think Frank would have been old enough at that point. I'm not sure how old he is, but he started wrestling, I think, in the late 70s. I think he broke in with Watts.
Well, this was he would have been. My guess is he was around 1920. This one was.
It was. Could have been him then.
It may have been. I don't know.
Anything like that?
Huh. Interesting. Well,
but there was a referee. Go ahead, Scott.
I was going to say, next on the list we had Eddie and Mike Graham.
Yep.
That's another one. I saw Eddie, I believe it was Mike's first match, unless he had one like in a spot show. His first match was in Orlando that I can figure out. And him and Johnny Walker wrestled Mike Webster and Doug Gilbert, who was wrestling as the professional at the time.
I want to say the first match he had in Tampa, which was probably after that, was against Bobby Shane, because they had a big deal. That's how they broke him in the business. Shane, with Eddie Graham down in Tampa, was kind of doing the same thing that he did with Lee Fields in Mobile. You know, he was aggravating him about being the calling him an old man and being the promoter and all that stuff. and he was kind of messing with Mike, and that's how they started Mike off with a pretty big push, getting him involved with Bobby Shane. Of course, I think he lost every match he worked with him, but they put him in that program. And that's enough. The infamous, the probably the most famous angle that ever happened in Mobile, at least in the 70s, was Bobby Shane slapping Lee Fields on TV. And all in the middle of that, a 13 or 14-year-old Ricky Fields came out and had no clue because he'd never been smart enough for the business. All he saw was this guy slapping his daddy, and he was out there biting Bobby Shane on the ankle on television.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Then they smartened him up a couple of years later. I think Ricky started refereeing when he was 16 or 17. And
hilarious. Good.
And of course, you could start talking about Fields and Welch and Goldens and all that. We'll be here the rest of the show.
We're going to have Jerry Barber grew up in Dyersburg, and he always told me that Herb Welch was like a daddy to him.
Yeah.
And Jerry knows everything about the Welch family. Here in the next couple months, I'm going to be interviewing Jerry and just picking his brain about the Welch family, because he knows a whole bunch. I'm really excited about that, because that's just a really interesting thing. J. Michael Kenyon, who is, in my eyes, the man when it comes to wrestling history, I mean, over above anybody, he talks about Southern wrestlers. he talks about how tough they were, and like just a bunch of fighters, you know. They just got in there and scrapped. They weren't really they weren't really wrestlers in the classical sense, you know. They were just scrappers, you know. They got out there and just fought. They loved it. They did hard. They just rather do a hard way than a blade.
Oh yeah. Well, that's something, and you know, maybe that'll spur you after talking to Jerry. Somebody needs to write the history of that family down. I approached Roy Lee and Jackie about it back several years ago, and they said that they had thought about that and were considering it, but then, you know, I kind of got the cold shoulder from that. But that, I mean, there's so many members of that. In fact, it surprised me when I told Scott several years ago that Joanne Phillips, the lady wrestler Joanne Phillips, was actually Jack Welch's daughter, JoJo Welch.
Yeah. The old Jack Welch.
Yeah. And then there was Doyle Welch, who was Herb's son, had a very brief career. There was also a Bobby Welch. I think that was one of Herb's sons. He wrestled briefly. You know, they didn't have long careers, but then, you know, there's so many of them. And then by the time you start branching off with Billy Golden and his brother Phil Golden, and you know, ran opposition to Gullis and Welch. And I'm thinking that whole deal was another one of Roy Welch's deals, like backing Lee to run up opposition in Nashville too. That whole guy, you could write a book just on the partnership of Roy Welch and Nick Gullis, and it'd be fascinating.
Absolutely.
Well, there you go, Scott. There's your next two books.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's plenty of material out there, believe me. Oh, man, if I could just retire from my job and write. I got so many books I want to write. They're all in my head. I just got to find time to do them, you know. But the one thing I will say about the Welches and the Fields, more than anybody else in professional wrestling, probably present or past, they doggone, even to today, they doggone protect the business. I mean, absolutely dead on that they will not, you know, expose the business. And that may be part of the reason Jackie and Roy Lee don't.
Very well be.
I have never
asked.
Well, I might be able to get them to, you know, do an interview, but I just don't know. I know, you know, Bobby and Don and Lee Fields, I mean, they were adamant about it. You know, they just, you know, it's like the time Charlie Smith got up there at the Mobile reunion and talked about doing a hard way and get what he got paid for it. They went ballistic. I mean, they just went crazy.
Yep.
You know, of course, I didn't understand that because it was all wrestlers, but they felt like the wives still didn't know it. And that's probably true. You know, they didn't even smarten their wives up.
I was in a motel room and the first time, I guess the only time Bobby and Evelyn Fields ever came up to Atlanta to one of our get-togethers there, they came up with Bob and Chris Kelly, and they were all staying in a hotel in Riverdale. And I went over there with them and was visiting with them that evening. We were just us. It was Bob and Chris and Bobby and Evelyn and myself sitting in a hotel room. And Bob started talking about blading or something like that. And Bobby Fields, I thought his face was going to fall off.
Uh-huh.
With the wives and me sitting there, even though I had been in the business and he knew that, but still I was a stranger to him, you know, for the most part. He'd been around me, but not a whole bunch. And he just, you know, he got mad. He told Kelly to shut up.
Well, he told me, you know, that same day you're talking about, and I've relayed this to Scott, And on some level, I can understand this, and then on other levels, you know, but he made the statement. He said, you know, he said, when I talk to people or people talk to us or talk to me, he said, they think they know what was going on, but they wasn't there. They wasn't in the ring. They're not sure. He said, there's still that little iota of doubt there. And he said, we should protect that.
Yeah.
And that was the way he thought.
I have to give them that, you know, that they sure did. I mean, I felt that way for a long time, but of course, by the mid, once Vince McMahon did his thing, you know, I thought, well, shoot, why do we need to be doing this? We need to be getting these stories down and start.
Yeah, when you use the word mark and you look back at the history of this business, you wonder who the real marks were.
I know.
I mean, seriously, you know, we were the guys spending 8 hours on the road to make $15.
You got that right.
Well, let me tell you this. I have found out, and I know Scott visits a lot of these wrestling-related message boards more than Bobby does, but I have found out just in the last few weeks here that the smarter they think they are, the bigger marks they really are. I've seen more stuff written about this whole thing between Daniel Bryan and this girl named AJ, I guess, is a character on Vince's show, and Punk, CM Punk, they bought into that and talking about this and who she should be with. I'm thinking, Lord, have mercy.
Man.
There's still marks out there. You know, even though they claim they know the terminology and they know who's a heel and who's a baby face and, you know, what a blade job is and what a hard way is, or they think they do, but they'll still buy into it. So, you know, I don't know.
Wow.
Let's get back to
this. I don't even know those two names you mentioned. I look at the message boards just for stuff on the old guys, you know, but I couldn't even tell you who those two people were. But, yeah, I do know what you mean, though. You know, so many of these people think they know what they're talking about, and they don't. But I go back to what I said before, you know, Sam Muchnick, Eddie Quinn, all those guys, Nick Gulas, none of those guys had been wrestlers, but they, you know, they knew the business. So I can't say if you've never been in the ring, you don't know what it's all about, like, you know, people do say, but I do say that, you know, there's a lot of people who think they do know, like Bobby says, and they don't.
The key word there is business, you know, and that's what some of these people never figure out, is that's exactly what it was a business. It's not to us, I'll give you a great example. Bo James may be listening tonight, but he called me, it's been maybe a month ago or a little longer. It was a Saturday morning and he called me and he goes, I'm going to make a statement to you that you haven't heard in a long time. And I said, okay, shoot. He said, I'm on my way to Saturday morning TV. And I said, really, where you at? And he was he was booking for some guy up in West Virginia, and they've got a TV up there they do on Saturday mornings. And he said that he went in the dressing room, and he said he set the show up to do it just like we used to do it. When the tape started rolling to record our one-hour show, that tape never stopped. There wasn't any, you know, oh, that didn't work right, let's do this over. I mean, it was whatever we got in that 58 minutes is what we got.
Right.
And he said that's what he was doing. And he said he sent this young guy out to do a 90-second interview. And he said he wanted the guy to make 4 points. And he said he told him, he said, this is the 4 points. He said, say it however you want to, but make these 4 points. He said they had to shoot that 90-second interview about 6 times because the guy could not talk for 90 seconds. And he said when he came back in the dressing room, he said he was just irate and he was all over this guy. And he said, what would you do if we were running 7 or 8 towns this week and you had to do an interview for every town? And he said the guy looked at him and he said, who works 7 or 8 times? And Bo says, anybody that ever made a living in this business.
Yep.
But I mean, guys today, whether they're on a message board or they call themselves a restaurant, they don't get it. They don't realize that this was the way we made our living. It was a business to us. But
that's
this
right.
was one of those strange businesses where it became your way of life.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And it, once you got sucked in, brother, you were in.
Yeah.
And, it's like Hardy said, once you're under that spotlight, brother, it never goes away. And you always want it. Even though you can't get it anymore, you always want it.
I got out of the business in 82, Bobby, and I just left it. Jerry Jarrett asked me, I guess it was when he was here a couple of years ago at the house, and he says, how come you never came around? He says, you left. He says, you never came around. You never came around the shows or anything. And I said, Jerry, I said, when I left it, I left it. And I said, I'll just never go back. Of course, then look where I am now.
Yeah.
But it's true. It's once you get it in your blood, you know, it's hard to ever get out, you know. And I don't know about today. Back in the day, you know, that's where I wanted to be. You know, I just look back on the great times I had, and I think, man, I loved it so much. And I was living. I've heard you say this. I was living my dream. That's
yes, sir.
Exactly what
yes, sir. My heroes became my friends, and I
that's
and
right.
I just. I mean, I. Oh yeah, I was right where I wanted. It wasn't a job for me for 6 months.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just. I couldn't wait to get in the car and go the next day. And then
right.
and then reality set in about 6 months later, and I thought, God, this is a job.
Yeah.
So, you know.
By the way, I was going to ask, how's that little lady of yours doing?
Which little? Oh, my wife?
I hope that's the only
that
one.
That little lady? She's,
yeah.
Other than her eyes are giving her fits, she's doing okay. The arthritis is really raging in her eyes. And we were at the eye doctor in December, and they told her she was just a few points from being considered legally blind. And
wow.
She goes back tomorrow, and we don't know what we'll find out tomorrow. But, I never knew arthritis could do the things it does. But, she's mean as a snake, and that will never change. And other than just her eyes, she's doing okay.
Good deal.
And she's sitting here listening to every word I say, but see, I can stay away from her because she can't see me. I can bob and weave.
There you go. I love it. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Well, Mike, what's next?
The Sheik and Captain Ed George.
Oh, please.
Did y'all meet Captain Ed George? I never did.
No, the only way I know of him is through the movie I Like to Hurt People.
Oh, yeah.
I'd never heard of him prior to that. And then I found out he was Farhad's son. And actually, Farhad had two nephews that wrestled. One of them, I guess he's still active today and is fairly well known, Sabu. Terry Bunk.
Yep.
And he had another son another nephew who I don't think he ever worked anywhere outside of Detroit. He refereed, he did ring announcing, and he wrestled some, and I thought of his name and it just slipped my mind.
I didn't know that.
Mike Thomas was another of the Sheik's. In fact, Mike Thomas and, going back to the Poffos, Randy Poffo, worked together in Detroit as the Mod Squad. They were tag team there. That was before he was Randy Savage. He was Randy Poffo, and he worked with Mike Thomas, and they were called the Mod Squad. That was probably mid-70s, somewhere along the line, after Georgia. What's that?
I said I wasn't familiar with him at all.
Yeah, I just know that from talking to Dave Brzezinski. Dave knows all that stuff about Detroit. Of course, he grew up there, and kind of like you, he's chopper, you know, was the official photographer for the Sheik, and then put together the programs and stuff, much like you did in Asheville for Gillis.
I'll tell you something about the Sheik.
What's that?
Sheik come into Tennessee, into Nashville one time, work a couple shots for us, and I stood there in the dressing room, and Nick Gulas came over, and he says, I need you to take a couple pictures of Sheik for just headshots for his passport. Of course, Sheik was dressed up. He always wore real nice clothes, you know. He really looked sharp. And so I said, sure. So I went over there and took a couple pictures. And, you know, Sheik talked to me a little bit. No big deal, you know. He was very nice, you know. And, I had talked to him before that a few times. Not much, but just a little bit. That night, I went out to ringside during his match to take some pictures. I forget who he was wrestling. I think he was with Fargo or somebody. But I went out to the ring. He comes out of the ring at the other end of the ring where I was crouched down at the ring apron, and he looks at me, and I knew he was going to do something because I could see it in his eyes, and he just stared at me. And he started walking towards me. Of course, I was going to, you know, I thought, you know, I'm not going to just sit here. I'm going to run because I'm not going to, you know, in a real world, somebody would run from somebody like him. And I knew, you know, I'd just been in the dressing room talking with him, you know, nice man. But I'm telling you what, there's something about him in the back of my mind. It was like I was sort of scared. I was sitting there thinking, is this guy real or is he just real? You know, I knew better, but you know what? He just had that thing about him that just made you wonder whether there was something really wrong with him or not. And I think that's part of the reason he got over so well. People believed what he did.
Yeah,
My mother told me if I couldn't say something nice about somebody, not to say nothing, so I'm just listening.
Well, I don't have anything bad to say about him because
well,
he's always nice to me, you know. But I know
for a fact there's a lot of people that talk about what wonderful things he did, and I'm sure he did. But I also know some of the things he did business-wise that were awful. And I was
sure,
on the short end of the stick on a couple of those deals and working for Barnett in a partnership arrangement, I was the one that took the heat.
So,
you know, he just, and Jimmy Powell, you know, Jimmy went up there and worked for him, and he tried to steal Jimmy's ring. So, you know, I mean, it's just, there's a lot of things, I'm sure he, over the years, as times got lean, he did some things that he probably might not have done years before, but just, I don't know.
Right. I know times were hard because when you were talking about Randy Savage, Mike, you mentioned Randy working for the Sheik in Detroit.
Yeah.
At that time, we had a trading deal going on. You know, Tom Ernesto was booking for Nick, and they traded talent with the Sheik. You know, we traded talent back and forth all the time. That's why Randy went up there. But, you know, I never really... The guys working for him at the time, none of them, you know, said anything bad about Sheik, but I have heard a lot of stories, you know. Otherwise, I really think, though, you know, when you're a promoter, it doesn't matter how good you do, how well you pay, there's going to be guys that are going to say bad things. You know, I want to say Sam Muchnick is the only guy I've probably never heard anything bad about, but then again, I've heard some stories from Carl Cox. You know, he wasn't real crazy about him. So, you know, just being the promoter, it's just that's the nature of the beast. You're going to take heat no matter what you do. And
yeah,
Bobby,
yeah.
You've been in there though. You probably saw things firsthand. That
well, yeah, there's some things firsthand. Well, let me give you one quick one. We did a deal. We were running Columbus, Ohio, and the first time we ran the show, Barnett met him that afternoon. He wasn't on the show. He had nothing to do with it. The building there told us if he had anything to do with it, they wouldn't give us the building because he had evidently had some – it was a brand-new facility, but his reputation had preceded him down in there for some things, and I don't know what they were.
But Barnett met him for lunch, and Barnett paid him for that town. I don't know what he gave him. I have no idea. I do not know what was in the envelope. My deal was to sit on the far side of the restaurant and just be a witness to the fact that he handed him the envelope. So this was the first time. The second time we ran it, or the third time, we decided to do a joint venture with him where we sent three or four guys to work Parkersburg, West Virginia, and Huntington, West Virginia, which were the Sheik's towns. The first trip we made, it was me and Ole, Saito, and Kevin Sullivan. And all I was doing was taking care of the town with the Sheik's people. We worked Parkersburg that night, sold out that Catholic high school, which he had not done in years. And people were coming to the door. I was standing at the front door, and people would come to the front door. And because I had done interviews to make the cycle of the tapes, they knew who I was. And they would say, hey, are those guys really here? And I'd go, yeah. But also on that same card, he had Thunderbolt Patterson advertised, and he had somebody else advertised. And, of course, they didn't show. And that's what he had been doing. He'd been advertising these people, and they never showed up. Well, I assured these people that Ole and Sullivan and Saito were there. We ran that. We went in. We did the town. We were going to run Huntington the next night, but we stayed in Parkersburg that night. I got a room. Saito got a room, and Ole got a room at a little mom-and-pop motel there. Kevin Sullivan, I had a double, and I told Kevin, I said, you can come stay with me if you need a place to stay. And he goes, no. He said, I'm going to stay with the Sheik's guys. He said, they're having a hard time. Now, from Parkersburg to Detroit was 450 miles. There were nine guys in one hotel room. They had the mattresses on the floor. Some were sleeping on box springs. One guy was in the bathtub. They were having to split the room because they could not afford on what they were being paid to get a room apiece, or two guys to a room, or even three guys to a room.
Wow.
12 o'clock at night, I'm sitting in the middle of the bed eating a pizza watching Johnny Carson, and there's a rap on my door. I opened my door, and when I did, Kevin Sullivan kissed me right in the mouth. He said, I have never been so happy to see somebody in my whole life. And I said, here's some pizza, man. There's your bed. But he went over to try to, you know, help him out, but he said when he saw what was going on, he couldn't do it. But that, you know, those kind of things, they were happening. And one of the guys that was involved in that thing was a guy named Malcolm Munro, who worked for the Sheik for years and was a great worker. He just never got a break nowhere.
Yeah.
He died here recently, within the past year or two, I think. But, you know, those kind of things were going on. And you know, there again, but all promoters were, you know, that went on not just there but everywhere. But that was just one of the things that stuck in my head. And, you know, all guys wanted to do was make a living, and he was living in that big, huge house up in Detroit, and these guys are starving to death. But so, you know, it was what it was.
Absolutely.
Let's jump in on three names he had on that list that I don't know why I didn't think. We need to get to Larry Hamilton and Joe Hamilton at some point. But
I could not believe y'all mentioned
we missed that one totally. But the other three that you got, that as a kid going to the matches that I remember, are the Torres brothers.
Torres brothers, yes.
Enrique, Ramon, Alberto.
Yep.
Enrique was the first one to come to Georgia, and I don't remember what year he got in here. Late '60s, and I did. Of course, I was a kid going to the matches, didn't know nothing about any of this. But Charlie has told me this story. When he first got here, they almost gave him his walking papers and sent him on his way before he ever worked.
Wow.
Because he was Spanish and he was dark-complected. And, I mean, the environment in Atlanta at the time was still somewhat segregated.
Right.
And it was, you didn't have blacks wrestling whites. And when he came in, and they said, well, one of two things is going to happen. The ladies are going to go crazy over him because he's got that movie star look, because Enrique had that little thin pencil mustache, and he wore his hair. I mean, he was a good-looking guy. They said they're either going to go for him or they're going to boo him out of the building, and if that's the case, then we know what we got to do. But he got over.
Yeah.
And then they brought Alberto in, and then later on they brought Ramon in, and them guys had a heck of a run here. They worked a big program with the Andersons, Gene and Lars.
Yeah.
They worked programs with Butcher Vachon and mostly Stan Vachon.
Yeah.
I can't pull his name out of my hair. You got that. So one of y'all was on the tip of your tongue, what his real name was.
Eric Palmer.
Yeah, yeah. And then they would bring, you know, when they would get a real hot deal going, they'd bring Mad Dog in.
Yeah.
But they had a heck of a run here.
Enrique had been in here twice. He came in Atlanta. He'd come in '64, and just for a month or so, I think it was. They didn't use him, but about mid-card. And then when he came back in '66, Ray Gunkel took him as his tag team partner. And that's where the segregation goes out the window. So if a promoter thinks a guy, especially a promoter that actually wrestles, if he thinks he can have a partner that'll help draw money, you know, have him as his partner. But then later, I think after he came in here in '66 is when Alberto came in, and that's when they started teaming. Now Ramon, I don't know that Ramon came in until it might have been later, like '67.
Yeah, it was later. I can remember that. And you know, one of the things, you know, Alberto just used that name. You know, that's what got Ox Baker over. It's sad to say, but the fact that Alberto died from an injury, that's what got Ox Baker over here so big.
Yeah, and then when he saw it got him over so big, he came in there and killed Ray Gunkel.
Jumped on Ray Gunkel. Yeah.
Yeah, they. I'll tell you one of the things that helped get the Torres brothers over, and I'd have to look this up because Frankie Kane told me a lot about it, but they worked with the Infernos.
The Infernos, that was another big run, yeah.
Yeah. And that was a big, big run right there. They drew a lot of money together, actually in a lot of six-man tags because they had all three of them in there.
Yep.
And they'd have
they JC Dykes. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying they had JC Dykes, you know, in there. As the third man in the six-man matches a lot of times.
Well, Alberto and Ramon were still touring or still working in Georgia, and they were being borrowed for Saturday nights in Dothan for probably a month or so, and they had a big program in Dothan against the interns, Bill and Joe.
Yeah.
But they didn't. That's the only city they worked. Only town they worked in the Gulf Coast territories was Dothan. That's, of course, they were still working in Georgia. But they did that quite a bit. They would borrow talent from the Georgia office.
So they never went to Mobile?
No. Ramon did. Ramon worked solo for most of '66. He was in fact, he was a Gulf Coast champion a couple of times. He and Salento Rodriguez were the Southern Tag Team Champions, which was the title that predated the Gulf Coast title, Tag Team title.
They worked with the Daltons a lot.
The Daltons, yes. And Ramon had a program with Chief Little Eagle. Little Eagle was a heel at that time. And Ramon had a program with him. But that was the only time the two, any of the brothers came in. And it was Ramon and Alberto. In '68, like I said, they had about a 4-week program. They only did it in Dothan, and of course they were working. Bill and Joe were working with the Perez brothers and the rest of the territory, which was of course was Ramon Perez and Roberto Soto.
Yeah,
and I guess Manny worked in Georgia some, didn't he? Bobby, didn't he and Roberto team up?
They were here some, yeah.
I think he was calling himself Cyclone.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Cyclones, they were. Here's a trivia question for you, and don't forget our trivia question. Anybody's listening wants to call in. I don't think anybody knows this, but you, Scott. Who Tor Kamada's brother was? Who was in the wrestling business? But we know Cyclone Negro had his kayfabe brother in Florida, Omar Negro, which was Omar Atlas, Buddy Marino, or Mario Marino, or whatever other name you know him as. But in Texas, there was a couple of Anaya brothers, Cyclone and Hurricane Anaya. Anaya was very well known, even had a version, I think, for Fred Kohler or Jack Pfeffer. A world championship at one time, one version of that. But do you know who Hurricane Anaya was?
Boy, I don't. I'd say Cyclone Negro, but it's only because you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm. Somebody you're very familiar with, you should be very familiar with.
Hurricane Anaya. Boy, I sure don't.
What about you, Bobby?
Have no clue.
Alex Perez.
Really?
Yep. I've got a picture of them together as the Anaya brothers.
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yep.
You know, there's a restaurant, a Mexican restaurant in Houston called Cyclone Anaya's Mexican.
Yeah, that's what he started. I think he started a chain of them. And you can go on the internet and you can look at their menu. It's still a very thriving restaurant. Of course, he's been dead for several years now.
Right, right. I guess his wife runs it now. I guess I believe she does.
Wife and probably kids.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be a nice place to visit. Of course, we don't ever go to Houston, but you know, we got enough names here. Probably to do another show.
Well, we obviously have, because we're not even through the brother. Well, before we're doing the father and son thing, let me throw this at you two. I came up with three mother and daughter teams.
Oh, cool.
And actually, the fourth one just popped into my head. Let's see if you guys can name them.
Well, Cora Combs and Debbie Combs.
That's one.
That comes easy to me because I know them and. Mother, daughter.
I don't know if they. When I say teams, I'm throwing it because a lot of them did, but they were both wrestlers. I don't know if they ever teamed at any point or not.
Oh, Marie Laverne and.
Anne Laverne, Mama Bia. That was another one.
Yep. Oh, boy. I can't tell you the others. I'm stumped.
Mula and Sherry Lee.
And that just reflects. Yep.
And this is one that I had. These two wrestled each other all the time, and I had no clue that they were even related. Dottie Downs and Debbie Johnson, mother and daughter.
Really? Wow.
Yep.
Know that.
It's strange and don't speak to each other, but they are mother and daughter.
Oh, my goodness. Who was the one before them you mentioned? Oh, yes, Mula.
Mula. And Pat Sherry was her daughter.
Yeah. Well, I never even thought about the mother-daughter combination.
Yep.
Good job.
What kind of relation? And if you started going into cousins, good.
Yeah, there you got Jerry Lawler and Honky Tonk and...
Carl Fergie.
Carl Fergie. Yeah. Now, Bobby, did y'all ever have any connection or trading or any talent or anything with the Culkins in Louisiana?
Not on a regular basis. Not that I know of. Not that I remember. The only trading I ever remember doing was between the Crocketts and us with the referees.
Oh, really?
They'd send Sonny down here for 2 weeks, and Ronnie'd go up there for 2 weeks, and they'd send Tommy Young down here for 2 weeks, and I'd go up there for 2 weeks.
Why would they do that?
I think just to move them around, just have somebody new.
Uh huh.
I mean, I was begging to go.
When did you go? Who was wrestling at the time? Or what?
Oh, geez. Ole and Gene were there. Paul Jones, Wahoo. Ricky Steamboat.
Okay.
You know, that era.
Yeah.
I bet that
was fun, I bet.
Oh, geez. Listen, I was telling them, and you may have heard this on the show, I was sitting around the office. I was off on a Monday, and they called me to go to Greenville. They need a referee in Greenville. I went up there. And the first week I went up there, they paid me $175. I thought, isn't this sweet? I went back 2 weeks later. They called. They wanted me to come back. I went back up there 2 weeks later, and they paid me $400. And I thought, this is really good. I went back 2 weeks later because they only run it every 2 weeks. I went back the third time I went up there. They paid me like $550. Now, that $550, wow. I earned every penny of that because the main event was Ole and Gene against Wahoo and Paul Jones, and they went an hour and 59 minutes to the curfew. They stopped it at 11:59.
Wow.
So, and that was the blow-off. But it was the second week I was there is when we almost had the riot when they went 90 minutes. And they got out of the ring, and I got turned around, didn't know where the dressing room was, and they started shaking the ring, and me in the ring, and I was like, well, here it is. That's when Klondike Bill came to my rescue. But, yeah, that was, I mean, you did a lot of traveling up there, but golly, they paid so well, and it was such a great place to work.
Right.
Well, Georgia, especially when TBS really started going, you know, the cable started going, branching out, there was a lot of different referees that came in from different. I know Jimmy McGuire would go up there and work for a few weeks. And
What's the other kid in Dothan?
Larry Brock
came in and worked some, yeah. But, you know, the thing, you're talking about swapping talent. You know, with that TV, everybody wanted to come here off. You know, everybody wanted to send somebody here, so they had to kind of, you know, be very careful how they did that. We did some swapping with Florida, of course. Eddie, you know, Barnett was part owner of that too, and you know, Watts would send people in sometimes, but it just, you know, I don't think we had a real working agreement with anybody in particular.
Huh. I know this in the 60s and into the 70s, maybe it was just between Rocky McGuire and Fred Ward, but a lot of guys that worked Columbus would come down. Jerry came in to Mobile and worked probably 2 or 3 months late 71 when he was, you know, still young in the business. But he came back probably 4 or 5 times and just worked Dothan.
Well, you know, you could make that Columbus TV and make Dothan with no trouble.
Right, right.
You know, that was sort of a natural thing there.
There are other guys that worked in Georgia that came and only did Dothan. Bill Howard did. Jim Lancaster did when he was working in Georgia. In fact, he and Ted Oates came in together. I think they worked against each other that night. Who else was there? Like I said, Jerry did a couple times. Dromo did. Bill Dromo came, but never worked in Mobile. Armstrong would come work Dothan, but he never worked in Mobile. It's when Lee had it. There were a handful of guys like that. Gene Anderson made a couple of spots, you know. And one time, I'm trying to think when it was, late 76, Rocky had shut down in November. And they ran two or three cards in December that was all Florida talent and Georgia talent. And that may have been the deal you were talking about when Barnett was looking at buying it.
Well, Barnett had an agreement in principle to buy that. And the deal was they were supposed to shut down and not run. And I remember I made Columbus TV on a Saturday afternoon, and Barnett got wind they were running New Brockton on Saturday night, and he had me drive to New Brockton, buy a ticket, go in, sit way up in the top where nobody could see me, and they didn't know me anyway unless they'd seen me on TV refereeing. But I sat down there and seen who worked that night, and it was a McGuire promotion. And when I went back, and that was sort of I don't know if that was the straw that broke the deal, but it didn't help any. Because the deal was they were supposed to let the territory sit idle and do nothing for like 30 days.
Yeah.
Do you remember what kind of deal Nick Barnett had with Nick Gulas, or do you remember anything about that when he sent in Stan Hansen, Ole, Tony Atlas, Tommy one time and into Chattanooga?
I have no idea what they agreed on for that.
We'd have our regular show in Chattanooga. And then we'd have one match from the Georgia office. I don't know if you remember that or not.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That would have been prior to me going and actually going to work in the back office.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, that was. I don't know.
That would have been 78.
By 81.
70,
yeah, I was going to say that by 81, Chattanooga was they were running on Saturday nights, the Georgia office was.
Yeah.
But this, when Nick still had it, they Barnett would, or somebody would send in just a tag team match from strictly out of the Georgia office. And I just didn't know if you remember that or not. That was I could find it here real quick. Stan Hansen. Let's see. Ole Anderson and Stan Hansen beat Mr. Wrestling 2 and Tony Atlas. January 8th, 1978. I was right. It was 1978.
I have no idea.
They did that a couple times. They'd send in guys, they'd send in a match from the, I guess, I know it's because y'all had such a good TV, and the Chattanooga people saw it, so they were probably calling, writing letters and saying, we want to see the Georgia people up here in Chattanooga.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen many times. I just remember, I know that one match I just mentioned, but and that was the time Stan and Ole against Walker, Mr. Wrestling 2 and Tony Atlas, that was the night that Nick bought, afterwards he bought Tony and Tommy, now that must have been another night, he bought Tony and Tommy Rich a sandwich afterwards, and before they left, they asked him if they wanted their money, and he says, "Well, I bought you a sandwich. What else do you want?"
Tommy Rich should have been used to that. I mean, he started with good luck.
Oh yeah, he worked here when I first started working for Nick. Tommy was here. He was just getting his feet wet back then. But here on March 5th, 1978, Lars Anderson and Stan Hansen beat Mr. Wrestling Number 2 and Tommy Rich. The next week, Mr. Wrestling Number 2, Tommy Rich, beat Ole Anderson and Stan Hansen. Stan remembers that. He tells me, he and I have talked about that several times. He tells me about it. He remembers coming in here working for Nick.
Now, was that actually Walker, though? Was it, didn't Don Green wrestle?
No, that was
wrestling
that was actually Walker, because that was strictly a match, strictly straight from the Georgia office.
Hmm.
That was really Johnny, so.
Hmm.
I'm surprised you don't remember that at all. That just...
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking now. When was I in Mobile, Mike? 77?
77, yeah. You went to Mobile in 77.
My daughter was born in January of 78, so I came back to work for the Atlanta office the 29th day. She was born on the 28th. I came back, which was a Saturday. Sunday would have been. I came back to work for the Atlanta office on the 30th of January, so I came back to run the ticket office.
Yeah.
So I had nothing to do with the back at all, and I was working Monday through. My wife and my kids were in Columbus, so I was working Monday through Friday. And as soon as I got through checking up at the auditorium on Friday night, I got my car and left. So I had no clue. That was at a time when I had no clue what was going on.
Yeah, during this time was when. Let's see, the big deal was Stan and Ole were a team. Stan wrestled Ric Flair during that time. You brought Bob Winkle into Atlanta to wrestle Wrestling 2. Abby and Tommy Rich were doing their deal. I think that's when they first started their deal, Abby and Tommy Rich. And were you in the office at that time?
Well, they had a girl running the – I went to Mobile. I went down there. The deal was I was going down there and stay for 2 weeks. And then I was supposed to go to Tennessee, and Tom was booking up there. And the deal was I was going to Mobile and stay for 2 weeks. Then I was coming. I was supposed to come to Nashville. And Tom called me, and Tom says, "Look, what I want you to do is probably not come here, but go to Detroit."
Yeah,
you were talking about doing it, and I knew I did not want to go to Detroit. I mean, I knew I didn't want to go up there. So when I got to Mobile, my first night down there, I wrestled Dick Dunn at the Farm Center there in Dothan, and McGuire called me back in the shower with Dick Dunn. I thought, well, I screwed up the first night, and I got back there, and McGuire asked me if I would stay all summer. He said, we can use you all summer in the middle of the card, and I said, well, I'm living in Columbus, Georgia. I said, if I can stay on the Alabama side, in the Florida side, I said, that will help me be good. I'll do what I can, and I'll stay. I said, as long as I can make a living, I'll stay. I mean, I didn't tell them about the other deal, but I was tickled to death because I wasn't going to Detroit. So my first night, that was on Saturday night, or that was Friday night. I worked TV Saturday. I worked New Brockton Saturday night. I was off Sunday. Monday they booked me in McLean, Mississippi, which was 400 miles one way.
Oh, my.
And when we got over there, we had them outnumbered.
There was three. Me, Sonny King, and Kurt Von Hess showed up. Speedy Hatfield was a referee, and that was all that showed up. And I'm telling you, we had them outnumbered. And we got through. You know, we went on. Anyway, I stayed down there about 2.5 weeks, and I saw. I mean, and they were using me just like they told me, middle of the card. I was working every night, but I saw real quick I wasn't going to be able to make a living. The territory was on the way down, and it was. So I got out of the business from. I don't even remember what month that was, but I stayed out of the business until my daughter was born, because when my son was born, I was actually on the road. I was not at home, and I promised I would be home, you know, for the second one. So Lisa was the week before Lisa was born. I got a phone call from Barnett, and he wanted me to come up to Atlanta to talk to him. So I didn't, you know, I went up there just to see what was going on. The girl that ran the ticket office had had a nervous breakdown. And I had worked with Nona for several years, and nice girl, but she had had a nervous breakdown, and they said, we don't know if she's going to be able to function or not. We need somebody in the ticket office that knows what they're doing, that can handle things, and also get along with her. So we hammered out an agreement dollar-wise and what my job would be and what I would do and not do, and it was strictly running the ticket office. That was it. No refereeing, nothing else, just running the ticket office. And I went back to work on that Monday, the 30th of January. I went back, and that for about a year, that's all I did was run the ticket office. They started, you know how it goes. You go in there on one thing, and then they say, well, we need a referee tonight here. We need a referee tonight there. Or we need this, or we need that. So, you know, it kind of worked in some other stuff, but it was never full-time again. And then Doug Smith decided to resign and leave the wrestling office. And Barnett says, can you come back and work the back office until I can hire somebody? And the deal, I was not supposed to be getting his job. I was just supposed to go back there and fill in. And when I got back there, after about a week, Barnett come in one day and he said, I want to talk to you. And he said, well, you take this full time and I'll hire somebody else to do the ticket office. And, he bumped my salary quite nice. And so that's how I got in the back office. And that's when I started working for him. And that's how my buddy Randy got the front office, because I hired him to run the ticket office. So
you remember the Rock Hunter managing a team called Wolfgang and Hank?
The Kelly twins.
Wolfgang and Helmut Schmidt.
That's when they were doing this talent, presenting these matches up to Chattanooga.
Okay.
Right during that.
Did we send the Schmidts up there?
No.
I was fixing to say, y'all got the short end of the stick if we sent them up there.
No.
Jeez, what a pair that was.
No, they sure didn't. It was generally Ole and Stan and Tommy and Tony and, you know, Mr. Wrestling 2.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they were the big names on the cable, so.
Absolutely. I'm sure that's why. I'm just curious what the deal was, you know. I wish I'd been able to talk to Barnett and really done a good interview with him before he died. I really, one thing, my big regrets, I never did try and, you know, to do that.
He was one of the smartest people I have ever met in my life. He could read people. I mean, you've heard, people have said so many bad things about him, and, you know, Ole blast him, and, you know, I mean,
yeah,
me and Ole get along fine. That it is what it is. You know, I was there. Ole stole the business. I know what he did, but you know. But the thing is Barnett could read people. Barnett knew he was a businessman first and foremost. You mentioned Tommy Rich. He put his eyeballs on Tommy Rich, and he knew that was money in the bank.
Right.
He didn't know if the kid could work. He didn't know if he could talk. He didn't know if he could chew chewing gum and walk at the same time.
Yeah.
But he looked at him and he told Ernesto at that TV station, he said, you put that kid on TV and let people look at him and don't let him open his mouth and don't let him wrestle. And that's exactly what they did with him. And Barnett went home and called Gulas and cut some whatever deal he cut to get him to come down here. And that was the beginning of it.
Oh, yeah.
He would he would talk to you about something, and he would walk out of the room, and this little game he played, he used to drive me crazy. He'd turn around and come right back in the room, and he would tell you what you were thinking. And nine times out of ten, he was dead on. And it was just a game he played.
And, wow.
You know, it was just smart guy. I wish you could have talked to him, too. That knowledge went to the grave.
I know.
And that's just... It is so sad nobody ever got that down.
That's why it's so important that we talk to these guys, and, you know, when we can, because, you know, they're all getting older, you know, and they're not going to be around. And, you know, I think guys like John Tolos, who never told their story, never, ever told their story.
Yeah.
And he's gone now, you know, and just because of the nature of the business, you know, none of it was ever recorded. None of that was written down, you know, and we've lost so many good stories. And, you know, I think it's so important that we do talk to these guys. And I'm so thankful for guys like Greg, Steve Johnson, and guys like them that, you know, are constantly calling these guys, and interviewing them, and picking their brain on different things.
Have you read Fred Blassie's book?
I read part of it. To me, it was a good book, but there was so much left out. I mean,
I wish somebody like yourself or Steve or Greg or somebody could have sat down with that guy and actually ask him the right questions. And those books that Vince publishes, they're Vince promos, all they are. I mean, but I met Blassie one time. He came in managing Volkoff. They brought him in out of New York, had Volkoff, and they brought him down too on some show here at the Omni. And I had never met him, and I went over to the dressing room, and I went over and I introduced myself, and I sat down with him, and I just sat there and talked to him. Must have spent an hour and a half with him. And
wasn't that cool?
He's asking me questions about Atlanta. Like, he wanted to know if Mammy's Kitchen, which was a restaurant over by the old wrestling office, was still there. And when I told him it was, his eyes lit up, and he said, man, he said, that biscuits and gravy. And he said, they still got it. I said, they still got it. I said, this was a Sunday night. I said, when do you fly out? He said, I fly out tonight. I said, man, I'd pick you up in the morning. We'd go eat breakfast if you could, you know. I mean, it was just, but.
Yeah.
There was such a knowledge there. I mean,
yeah.
Oh, jeez. I just hate it that these guys are gone.
I know. We've lost so much. We really have. And I just, that's one of the reasons I wish I didn't have to, you know, I'm a few, couple, 2-3 years away from retirement. But as soon as I get there, buddy, that's all I'm going to do is concentrate and fix these guys' brains.
We lose many, you know, each year, and the ones that are still around, unfortunately, their mental capacities are not what they were. People like Ness Stinking and Nick Bockwinkel, and it's a shame. It is an absolute shame that the people writing the history of wrestling and the people that most people remember and are talked about on the internet are people like Hogan and you know.
Yeah.
It's just to me, it's a shame that most people think that Hulk Hogan invented professional wrestling in 1984.
Yep.
it's sad to say, but you talk to people, and that's what they think. And today's fans, and the ones that follow the product now, you know, Hulk Hogan to them is Lou Thesz. He's old ancient history.
You know?
They think that The Rock invented wrestling. Steve Austin invented wrestling, but I don't know.
I know. We've
lost so many.
Yeah.
I mean, guys who's you know, and you mentioned Steve and Greg, and they do have done great. Tim Hornbaker's another one. I'm reading Tim's latest book now that I helped him with. And I am so thrilled at this book that Ken Lucas is actually listed in it. You know, somebody actually thought Ken Lucas was worthy enough. He's a guy who worked in dozens of territories, worked on top from basically the time he started in the business, held well over 100 titles, and, you know, had a 30-year career, worked 7 different NWA world champions. Everybody in the business thought very highly of him. But you talk to somebody now who, you know, you say Ken Lucas deserves to be in anybody's Hall of Fame, and like, well, I never saw him on cable TV.
Yep.
I mean, how many of you saw Jim Lomas on cable TV?
Yeah.
Charlie Smith refereed some of his early matches.
Yeah. Jim Lomas.
Him or God, Frank Gotch.
Yeah. I think he was Ed Strangler Lewis's driver, wasn't he?
Me and Charlie were talking after the show last week. You know, at one time in Georgia, there were four referees in Georgia, all with the last name Smith.
Yep.
Wow. It was Charlie Smith, Eddie Smith, Ken Smith, and then finally Doug Smith.
Man,
I'm surprised they let you keep your last name to just name you Smith.
Well, you know, it's. Yeah, I tell people this all the time. You know, Charlie's wife pays me good money to babysit him. That's why I go with him to Mobile and you know, to Las Vegas and those places. But my first trip I ever made in the wrestling business was with Charlie Smith. He is responsible for getting me to go to Mobile. He convinced me that it was worth the trip. And, my wife says he created a monster. These things are so important to me.
Yeah.
I've even developed a little bit of a liking for Las Vegas.
Yeah,
just to see the guys. But it's just, these things are so important, man. You're right. We're losing these guys so quick, and you know, there's no guarantee the next one to go won't be me or somebody else. And I just, man, I don't want any regrets.
Well, we're getting down to the wire here, but I want to throw this out. We're talking about all the names of the referees. Here's how convoluted Mobile, Alabama was in 1971. Ron West came in as a referee. He couldn't use the name West because Kevin Sullivan was working there as Johnny West.
Yep.
The reason Kevin Sullivan was working as Johnny West is because Benny Hazar was working there as Eddie Sullivan, so he couldn't use Sullivan. So guess what name they gave Ron West?
What?
Ron Wright.
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
Oh, I love it.
That is hilarious.
And that if I know, and I've never confirmed this with Ronnie, but they probably asked him, is there another name you want to use? And him being from East Tennessee, Ron Wright was probably the name that popped into his head the quickest.
He picked, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But anyway, since nobody called in and guessed, fill the beans here, Scott. Who was Torquemada's brother?
Well, Torquemada's real name is McRonald Kamaka.
Right.
There's another Hawaiian wrestler that was really one of the first wrestlers I ever met, but that I became good friends with in Florida. And his name is Koatiki. His real name is Edward Kamaka.
You're kidding.
I have no idea. Koatiki.
Boy, that brings back some memories. I hadn't thought of that name in a while.
Yeah, he's the one that when you cut yourself, he'd faint.
I was fixing to say, he couldn't stand the sight of blood.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, and somebody, I guess it was Steinborn, one time was making a trip with him, and Tiki was driving, and Steinborn ripped a big fart, and he says, Tiki couldn't believe he did it. He says, you fought in my car. Why are you fought in my car? He said, fought. But, yeah, he was my first good friend, and he still lives in Hawaii now. He had a whole bunch of property over there, a pretty prestigious place, and the government came in just like they do here and seized a lot of it. They said it's for the, you know, the what do they call that, eminent domain, you know,
yeah.
Where they need it. Look good. It's a bunch of garbage, is what it is. But they seized a bunch of his property, and he fought that for decades, I guess, trying to, you know, get it back or keep them from taking it. And it was a real shame. I haven't talked to him in 4 or 5 years, I guess. But He was a good guy. He was real nice to me, you know, when I first met him, and we hung around a lot. He's actually the guy that gave me my first and only body slam, and that body slam is what convinced me I wanted nothing to do with being in the ring. There wasn't one tiny piece of hair left inside me when I hit that ground. Man, I tell you what, I couldn't breathe. I said, I'm going to take pictures. That's all I want to do.
If I'm not mistaken, you have to verify this with Charlie. I think Charlie actually gigged him one time. They wanted him to get some juice, and he gigged him. And if I'm not mistaken, he put his hand up to his head, and he looked at his hand, and Charlie said he fainted. I'm pretty sure it was Charlie told me that story. But I refereed a couple of three matches, when I first started with him. But he was funny to be around. I know that.
Yeah, real nice guy.
Well, also, Scott, you had emailed me that you can bring on a special guest in 2 weeks. But in 2 weeks, I'm actually going to be traveling.
I'll make it three.
Let's make it three, because Bobby will be absent that week. But you're going to make us wait 3 weeks before you tell us who it is?
Yes, sir. I'll tell you that
tonight. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and plan it.
All right. We're on vacation. One Thursday night, we're going to be on vacation, and I think it's not this coming week, but the following week, so I'd be okay that third week. In fact, I couldn't do it. That's 2 weeks from now anyway, now that I think about that. So, yeah, that'd be great.
August 9th, I feel will be our special guest. We'll be a special guest.
Well, plug Scott's website now. We never plug people's books.
That's right.
plug his website so he can tell people where to get his stuff.
Mike, you told me you'd plug my site if I came on. I got so much of kicking out of Butcher on the show that other night. He kept saying, Mike, you said, and he didn't give you time to do it. He never stopped talking. I'm getting great stories, but he never gave you a chance.
He was great, though. I'm going to have to, I would love to have he and Mad Dog on it together.
Oh, yes.
The rest of us, that'll be like having Steinborn on here. We won't even have to talk.
That's right.
Scott's website, Crowbar. And Scott is the owner, operator, publisher, writer, and chief bottle washer at Crowbar Press. Sweeps up the place at the end of the day when everybody else goes on. And his website is onewrestlinglegends.com. Great site. If you care at all about the history of wrestling, Scott Peel is your man. You mentioned J. Michael Kenyon, the old fall guy, as he calls himself. Believe me, I'm not saying this because you're a friend of mine, but you rank right up there with him. And I've said that before I knew you. And
I appreciate
I can't
that.
Wait for you to retire, too, because that means whatever happened to will start up again.
That's right. That's where I'm headed.
Are you still working on the book with Fargo?
Oh, yeah. In fact, this next week, Angela's going to be out of town for 3 days, and I've got 24 hours worth of interview material to type, and that's all I'm going to work on next weekend. That's all I'm going to do because I'll be here alone, and I'd like to find somebody. People like to help me do that. I may end up doing that because there's a lot of stuff to do. We still got to talk for several hours, get some more stuff. But man, he has a great story. So, I mean, it's
going to be good. That is one person that does not need to slip away from us without getting his story down.
We've got it on tape, but. I want him to be here because he's all excited about it and he wants to see it, so I definitely want to make sure we get it for him.
Right.
He has they're ready to read it. I mean, they're constantly telling him, they want to read his book. So. Anyway, thank you all, guys. I appreciate you very much. You have me on.
Thanks, guys. It's been a great show.
I have good. Had a good time. Y'all take care, and tell Jerry hello for me, and I'll talk to y'all soon.
I will do it.
All righty. Thanks,
okay.
Scott.
Here's Scott.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Well, Bobby, thanks again, and hopefully Jerry didn't get indicted.
I heard that. I'll check the paper in the morning.
Back with us next week. And we'll get together next Thursday and see what kind of trouble we can get in.
Sounds good, man. Have a good week.
You too. Good night.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.